I'm Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel. This is a podcast episode brought to you by Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. Our Vayikra series, Kedushas in the Details, explores the way the laws in the book try and elevate each of our most basic human functions, food intake, bodily functions, relationships, spaces of worship, and time. This year, I will be taking a particularly honest and candid look at the way these laws do or do not yet function in our lives. I remind you that sponsoring a podcast is a wonderful way to mark any occasion. Write to me at podcast@matan.org.il or check out the donation webpage on the Matan website, or you can contact the office directly. Parshat Tzav can be divided into two general topics. The first is a delineation of the procedures for the five main types of sacrifices, and the second are the miluim, the seven-day ceremonial inauguration of the Mishkan. In Parshat Vayikra, the order of the sacrifices begins with those that are self-motivated. We spoke about that last week, the Olah, the Mincha, the Shlamim, and then continues and speaks about obligatory sacrifices. Parshat Tzav, the order is actually fixed differently. The first four classifications, Olah, Mincha, Chatat, and Hashem, are all grouped together in that they have a degree of sanctity which precludes taking the food of the sacrifice from the area of the Mishkan. They are Kodshei Kodshim, highly sanctified. But the Shlamim sacrifice can be eaten by non-priests anywhere in Yerushalayim. That is a Kodshei Kalim, lightly sanctified. This order reflects the group being addressed in this week's Parsha. In both listings, both in Vayikra and Tzav, we move from higher levels to lower levels, in the original from voluntary to obligatory. But when it comes to the first Parsha in Vayikra, we speak about human motivation. But for the priests, we talk about what they're responsible for, which are degrees of sanctity, and what is allowed to leave the Mikdash or Mishkan grounds, and what they are allowed to eat. So we have overlapping details, but since the audience is really a different audience of the two parshiot, the way that the korbanot are listed and how they're classified are slightly different. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with my colleague and friend, Shuli Mishkin, who is a licensed tour guide and who loves guiding people of all ages around Israel. Alongside her regular guide work, she teaches tour and text courses in the Jerusalem branches of Matan and Pardes and provides tours for special needs students in the Darkeinu program. Shuli was a Matan scholar in the early years of its existence. Shuli, it's a pleasure to have you back on the podcast.
It's always great to be here, Yosefa.
So this conversation today is sort of, I think, a natural continuation of what we spoke about last week. Last week in my conversation with Rabbi Alex Israel, we spoke about sort of what emotional undertone is really there and present in the korbanot, in the whole act of bringing a korban. But we also spoke about whether this is something that will ever return. We sort of devoted the last part of our conversation to, you know, third Beit HaMikdash, are we going to try and, you know, go back to korbanot? And today we're actually going to sort of take a sort of a step back or a step in the middle of those pieces to speak about how Chazal took this world of the Mikdash, which no longer was directly relevant to their reality, and tried, I think, to bring those ideas or some of the intentions and the religious sentiment that was preserved and sort of inherent in the Korbanot act and bring them into our lives once we no longer had a Mikdash. So, and I think that because Chazal were so successful, which we'll talk about in our conversation, we then get to this conversation of, wait, are we even going to need them again? Exactly. Are we going to go back to having that? So today we're going to sort of fill in that element of the conversation.
Okay, so exactly. When you read the Parsha, when you read so much of Vayikra, it's very foreign to us, and that's exactly because Chazal were too successful. But I want us to take a step backwards. I want us to, well, we've been having a very, very difficult year here in Israel. Let's go back to another difficult year, and that's the year 70 of the Common Era. In the year 70 of the Common Era, if you were among the lucky few to survive the attacks, both internal and external, and to live to see the day after Tisha B'Av of the year 70, you woke up to an insane new reality, which is a reality without the Beit HaMikdash. Now, for us, like we said, Chazal were too successful, and we're not shocked by that. We're like, of course you can be a Jew like that. But Chazal are looking at a world where being a Jew is suffused with going to the Beit HaMikdash, and if you can't go, paying your taxes to the Beit HaMikdash. your holiday life, the cycle of the year revolves around the Beit HaMikdash, your personal life, right? Things like, what do you do if you've sinned? How do you repent? Revolves around the Beit HaMikdash. Having children, right? You bring your korbanot to the Beit HaMikdash. Everything revolves around the Beit HaMikdash. What do you do next? What's the next step? And that's really what we're going to talk about today. Now, I think the first thing we have to understand is the depth of the shock. We have a very well-known Gemara in Bava Batra, where Rabbi Yoshua, who's a Levi, serves in the Beit HaMikdash, sings in the Beit HaMikdash, and he encounters this group of people who are in mourning. And they say to him, you know, now that the Beit HaMikdash has been destroyed, we're not going to eat meat and we're not going to drink wine because there's no more meat on the Mizbeach. There's no more Nisuch HaYayin, right? Pouring libations of wine on the Mizbeach. We are going to keep ourselves from meat and wine. And Rabbi Yoshua pushes them and he says, okay, very nice. So you shouldn't have bread because of the Shtei HaLechem, and you shouldn't have fruit because of the Bikurim. And finally, he says to them, right? He goes to the absurd. He says, you shouldn't have water because of Nisuch HaMayim. And they understand that this direction that they're going in isn't right. And he says, you can't mourn too much because it's not sustainable. You can't not mourn because this terrible blow has fallen, but you can't mourn too much. And he institutes this middle way, which we still do today, right? Breaking the glass at the wedding, putting up a zecher on our walls, right? We want to remember, but it can't be too much. So Rabbi Yoshua is confronted kind of with the opposite problem of what we have. They want to mourn too much. We can't find space to mourn at all. But this incredible shock of what's going to be, right? What do we do now? And maybe an even better and I think less well-known story we have in Avot de Rabbi Natan, where Rabbi Yoshua is walking with his Rebbe, with Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. And he says to him, what are we going to do now that we don't have a chatat? How are we going to atone for our sins? And Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai says, you know, you're right. That's a terrible problem. But God gave us the opportunity to do chesed, gemilut chesedim. That's going to be instead of the chatat. But this issue of, well, what do we do now? How do we go on like this? That's a huge problem for Chazal. And that problem, I think, comes to the fore the most when we think about holidays, right? We think about holidays that essentially revolve around the Mikdash. And the two most powerful examples, of course, are Yom Kippur and Pesach, right? We think about the difference between our Yom Kippur and their Yom Kippur, or our Pesach and their Pesach. The differences are staggering, right? If you learn Masechet Yoma, so the first, all of it, right? The first nine chapters, 9 out of 10, I think, right, of Masechet Yoma are about the Avoda, are about what you do. And it's about this crazy spectacle, right? What was your Yom Kippur if you lived close enough in the time of the Mikdash? You went to the Mikdash and you watched this incredible show, this three-ring circus, right? With the Kohen Gadol, with all of these animals, with different venues and different things going on. Yes, there's atonement. Yes, there's vidui, but mostly it's about watching what's going on. What's our Yom Kippur? Our Yom Kippur is a much smaller version of that, right? Our Yom Kippur revolves around shul, revolves around this very long, very important, but very long day in the Beit Knesset, right? Pesach is even stronger contrast. What's their Pesach? Their Pesach is packing everybody up, get on the donkey, go to Yerushalayim, bring your korban, sing Hallel from the rooftops, right? It's an incredible spectacle. It always makes me laugh, right? We do so many things in the Seder to keep our children awake, right? Nobody had to be kept awake in the time of the Mikdash. It's super exciting. And ours is completely different.
So a few thoughts in response to that. The first is that, you know, I'm just imagining, I think there's a lot of images that come to mind when you think about the shift or the shever, right? Whatever that broken moment of when the Mikdash is destroyed. I think that, you know, in an episode a long time ago, I brought in the idea from Bruce Feiler about life quakes. It was with Molly Brofsky when we spoke about, about the Meraglim. And I mean, this was like a national life quake for Am Yisrael, where you are functioning one way, you have to change languages, you have to change religious languages, really fairly overnight. And I think that, like all processes of grieving, like you have, there's some sort of process, whether it's linear stages or it's something else. Like there's, you know, we had to go through a process in order to figure out how to speak again, but in a different way. And I think that very much moving into Eretz Yisrael and having Medinat Yisrael, it has also dramatically shifted our religious language. I'll just give a tiny example from yesterday about two of the things that you just said. Last night I was at a wedding, and the Meseder Kiddushin said to the Chatan that I'm putting ash, right, on your afar, on your head. And he said, this is from Har HaBayit. It's also with from Gush Katif.
Wow.
Mamash. And like meaning the really like a very right now moment of right. like
ancient, you know, and modern.
Ancient and modern. And yesterday morning with work, which is, it's fun that I get to call this work, we took them to sort of this very beautiful farm / outpost close to where we are. And we davened on this gorgeous deck overlooking this amazing wadi. And we davened, you know, for Rosh Chodesh and said Hallel together. And it's a kind of experiential kind of tefillah and experiential like religious moment that I certainly didn't grow up with anything like that.
No, I don't think we've had those moments for centuries.
Yeah, and it wasn't with a Beit Mikdash, but it's definitely much closer to that than it was to like a shul in, put in whatever state you want, in whatever other country. Meaning there, we're in a shift also now where our religious language is shifting. It creates a lot of challenges within the religious world in all different directions. But I just want to say that it's not just something really distant in our past. Like I think we're living through a moment now also where Medinat Yisrael really impacts our Judaism, and we're figuring it out as we go along. But here it's in the positive, happy, celebratory sense, and not the negative sense.
Although I think also in the past 5 months, we've also been dealing with, I mean, I know so many people have said this to me and I felt it also. You read Tanakh now,
Yeah. The
language is like shouting at you. This is our reality now. So yeah, we're in a very interesting shift of going to the past, but also in the future. And again, we have to deal with, to a certain extent, this kind of gullus mentality of living without the Mikdash. And like we said, Chazal being too successful, right? I think, to go back to our problem, right? Mm-hmm. So Chazal need to do a few different things, right? And we say Chazal, it's obviously a very vague term. We're talking about mostly the generation of Yavne, right? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Akiva. What are they doing? They need to do a few things. First of all, if we go back to our examples of Yom Kippur and Pesach, can we actually fulfill the needs of the day without a Mikdash? Mm-hmm. Meaning, God says, bring the Korban Pesach to the Mikdash. We don't have a Mikdash. God says, do this Seder HaAvodah. We don't have a place to do that. So that's sort of what Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying. We can reach atonement through Gumilu Chasadim, through Tshuva, right? Yoma Talks, the last parak of Yoma Talks, a lot about how do we do Tshuva and what kind of Tshuva and what's Mechaper and the day itself being atoning for us. Because we can't bring those Korbanot, the public and the private, to atone. So we have to find a substitute. And Pesach is really a fascinating one. How do we have a Chag HaPesach without the Korban Pesach? And Chazal create this new ritual, which brings in many different things, right? They create the Seder. It brings in the matzah and the maror, but it takes education. And for us, certainly I think for our younger generation, the educational aspect of the Seder is the most important, right? How do we teach our kids? That becomes, we have to make it experiential. We have to take over from this natural experience of going to Yerushalayim. We have to create an experience through the Seder. Fascinating, if you look back in Psachim, there's actually a conversation of, can you have roasted meat at your Seder, right? We are familiar with the tradition that we don't do that. Mm-hmm. But actually we know, and we have texts ranging from the Gemara up until the Cairo Geniza that talk about people having tzli, having roasted meat at their Seder, because they wanted to bring a ke'ilu Korban Pesach, right? So how do we bring that into our experience? How do we fulfill those needs? We also have to figure out, how do we remember the Mikdash and move on? And that's where we get to all of the takanot of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, which we won't go into, but taking the lulav 7 days, even though you're not in the Mikdash, right? Blowing the shofar on Shabbat if you're in a place of a Beit Din. Taking the Mikdash and bringing it into our communities so that we remember it, but we're still able to move on. Okay, so that's a different part of the story. But I think...
I just want to say that with regarding Pesach, is that the question, there's a few different elements to the question. One question is, can we take practices that we did in the Mikdash and still do them now? That's one element. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes, we could still have a shofar. Yes, we could still have a lulav. Like, meaning we can take it from the public precinct and bring it into the private. And then there's a question like, what is the ofi? What is the character of the chag going to look like? Like, literally, and I just, again, it's fascinating because, like, this year, there's been a lot of writing about, like, are we going to, in Israel, are we going to change the ofi of Simchat Torah from here on in? Meaning, like, a religious question of, like, someone suggested splitting up Shemini Atzeret and Simchat Torah in Israel so that it doesn't have a negative association. Like, meaning, literally, like, these questions which are being raised by lay people in the current setting. But the question becomes, what do we want to emphasize? And when Chazal turn Pesach into an educational enterprise, they're actually taking what's written straight in Tanakh, right? But they're putting a different emphasis on it. So that's different than bringing the shofar into our home. But it's saying, well, we have all these psukim which emphasize the memory and what we're supposed to do, that Pesach is supposed to be a chag that we sort of sharpen our national memory. But that is to take what existed in the tradition before them and just shift the focus or shift the emphasis in what they were going to do later on. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's two different motions, I think, of how to translate this into a world without a mikdash.
Yeah, you have to be able to remember. Right? You have to be able to continue the yearning, right? One of the interesting takanot of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is he says the whole day that we bring the Omer to the Mikdash, we don't eat the new wheat. Why? Because Meherah Yibaneh HaMikdash. We hope the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt very, very soon. And what if it's rebuilt and we don't know if they brought the Korban, if they didn't bring the Korban? We know today there's no Korban, so why are we being so careful? No, Meherah Yibaneh HaMikdash. The Mikdash should be built today, every minute, right? So you have to balance, and it's very complicated. You know, you brought up Gush Katif. You have to think about what is our reality today while not giving up on our dream. You know, in Gush Katif, there was a lot of criticism of thinking only about the protest movement and not thinking about the day after. Mm-hmm. And Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai tries to do both. Mm-hmm. He says, we have to think about how we're going to behave now, but we can never lose sight of this larger goal. Right. And Yom Kippur, I think, is an even more fascinating example. Right. Think about our Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is so different from Yom Kippur of the Mikdash. And yet we bring the Mikdash into our Yom Kippur. Right. Most obviously by doing the Seder HaVodah. Mm-hmm. Right. We read through exactly what they do. But not only we physically do things. Right. We do the bowing. Right. And the prostration when we say Shem Hashem, which we don't, of course, say the real Shem Hashem. But we do that. Many people have the custom to wear white. Right, wearing white, like looking like the Kohanim. Many people, some people, you don't see it as much anymore. I saw it when I was growing up. There are people who have the custom of standing the entire day on Yom Kippur, all through the davening, because there's no sitting in the Azara. Right? Do you remember that from when you were growing up?
I mean, I remember it was like a frum thing to stand for all of Chazarat HaShatz, but I have to say, long ago, I abandoned that.
I just once remember I was seeing pregnant like and realized the night,
what was
doing
nice
that.
About sitting, I never sitting went back nice. To standing.
But right, so we do that. We have an emphasis on mikvah, largely for men today, even more, more and more for women.
I take all my kids.
Right, so going to the mikvah. And that's, of course, nothing to do with Nida and Taras HaMishpacha. It's to do with getting prepared for Yom Kippur, for the purity, for the Tara. Mikvah Yisrael Hashem, as Rabbi Akiva tells us at the end of Yoma. All right, so we try to bring some of that experience of the Mikdash and Yom Kippur into our Yom Kippur today. But it's not the same, right? There's a very well-known article that was written by Rabbi Yoel ben Nun probably at least 30 years ago. Hechan hi beitenu ha'amiti, where is our true home? And he writes exactly about this issue of Chazal's success. And he says, we think that Pesach is sitting around the table with your extended family. We think that Yom Kippur is standing in shul all day. It's not. It's not. It's not the true meaning of those holidays. And we have to understand what is the true meaning and what is the true celebration or commemoration of Yom Kippur, of Chag HaPesach as opposed to Chag HaMatzot, right? He goes through a whole story like that. So yeah, Chazal were very successful.
Look, I guess the question that comes to mind specifically regarding that point about Rabbi Yoel's article is, I mean, realistically, emotionally, you can't really hold on to both over the span of thousands of years. Like, it's not a realistic expectation. Even mourning, you know, is something that will stay with people, but of course they still move on. They're happy. They live lives, you know, like you had mentioned earlier. And I think that I don't personally look at their success and say, oy vey, do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think that their success has, yes, it leads to genuine questions of, okay, well, they've shown us a different way of functioning religiously. Do you know what I'm saying? And it's been successful. I don't know if that means that then, you know, I have to decry it, or I have to feel sad about it. Yeah, is Tisha B'Av a really, really hard day for us on a national level? Yeah, I think that for individuals, it's a day you really struggle with to feel anything genuine. I think that a lot of times, though, they serve an important function in that they remind us what our focus is supposed to be. Meaning, I may not feel sad about the Mikdash, really, but I do as a national consciousness. We're people who remember something that happened thousands of years ago. Meaning there's just I think that there's an importance just in that act of memory, even if like the emotional tenor has, I would say, permanently shifted because our religion permanently shifted. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense. Although I think that he would say, no, you need the emotional power of the moment. But I agree with you that it's very difficult to feel that.
You know what I'm saying?
I agree with you. But I think also what you're saying, that we're reaching a different moment in our history here, does help us to think about different realities, different ways of creating our Judaism.
You know this so much as a tour guide because it's your daily work, but our religious experience in Israel is more tactile, it's more experiential, and there's something about that. I know that's something that pulled me to this country very much. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something about that whole experience that does sort of, you know, it does sort of start to harken back to something that was a broader experience than a text in a book, right? And everything that was an echo of what once was. Mm-hmm. I feel like we are slowly crawling back to something that's like
You're living on the stage. You're not sitting in the audience. Other thing I want to talk about with what Chazal do, and this is I think a less obvious thing, and I think it's a fascinating thing. In rabbinic literature, there is what I think is a conscious attempt to always remember the Mikdash, even though they're in very tiny details, right? Starting at the bigger picture, look at the six orders of the Mishnah, Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, 2 3/4, let's say, deal with the Mikdash and Eretz Yisrael, right? With a reality that is gone from the world, right? So we have Taros, we have Kodshim, we have most of Brachot, right? Which is, we stick with Brachot, right? But really, we're talking about Peah, and we're talking about Shemitah, and we're talking about Orlah, and all these things connected to the land of Israel. So already the Mishnah, which is redacted only more than a century after the Churban, right? And written down, who knows even, right? But it's clearly in a post-Mikdash world.
Yeah.
But it says, look, we have to think about the Mikdash. We have to talk about it.
They also never know. They never remember. They don't remember. What do they do?
They're always going back to that memory.
Well, did they bring 700 or 500? Was it in the Churban in this place or that place? And like, the argument isn't necessarily about like halachic truth. The argument is just no one can remember anymore.
No one can remember because it's far away. faraway time.
Yeah.
It's a faraway time. And you have certain Tanaim who are like guys, the memory guys, right? Yeah. They remember what it used to be and will ask them the questions, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and a few other people. So, but the idea of enshrining that in our literature, super important.
Yeah.
Okay. And then if you go a step further, and this I think is really fascinating, if you look at the opening of many of the Masechtot, they are always drawing us back to the Mikdash, even though ostensibly they have nothing to do with the Mikdash, right? What's the very beginning of Masechet Brachot? When do you start? From when do you say the Shema at night? What's our reference point? Oh, it's from the Mishmarot Keunah. What time that they're waking up in the middle of the night? Yeah, really? Like, you can't say it's from, I don't know, with a star appearing, the middle. There's so many reference points. We're going back to the Kohanim. Okay? Shabbos. What's our basis for Shabbos? The 39 Malachot, for which you make the Mishkan, right? What we just dealt with in the Parshiot before.
Yes, two episodes ago.
Right.
Yes.
What's our, when we look at Sukkah, right? The very beginning of Masechet Sukkah in the Gemara talks about the minimum height of a sukkah has to be 10 tefachim high. The minimum height, it's the same as the height of the Aron, of the Ark. What's the connection? There is no connection. What's the maximum height? And we have this in Eruvin also. The maximum height is the doorway of the Mikdash, 20 amot. Right? You're always pulling in these ideas, and maybe the best example, and this is not a Mikdash example, but an Eretz Yisrael example, where do we have our shiurim, right? We talk about sizes, halachic sizes, right? There's an opinion that it should all go by the Shivat Haminim. How big is a Zayit? How big is a Te'ena, right? We always want to be referring back to things that happened in the land of Israel, to things that happened in the Mikdash, even when we're not living in that reality anymore. Chazal are saying, subconsciously, you want to be in that reality all the time. Those should be your frames of reference and not whatever the sizes are in the country that you're living in or the pop stars. Or think about the Mikdash.
Right. Okay. First of all, it's such a great example because it underlies so many things we do and unless I think about it so much that way. But I think that what's fascinating also is that the Chazal, who you're speaking about, again, they themselves didn't experience the Mikdash.
Correct.
Meaning they themselves are enacting a memory through their scholarship. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not based on what they, so I'm saying it's already generationally removed from it, which is fascinating. And I think that exactly, you kind of hinted to it when you said pop stars, but meaning this is a religious question in general. Like, what is your frame of reference? Do you know what I'm saying? How much are you, is your frame the, I don't love the word secular world, but like how much is your frame sort of the broader world for all different things, the music you listen to, the things, you know, the things you see, whatever all those seeing is, you know, whatever those acts of seeing are.
Don't say bigger than a bread box. Say bigger than the Lechem HaPanim.
Right. And I think that a lot of times today, I think it's a very relevant example because people do this all the time. People adopt, quote unquote, from speech. Even people's choice to delineate their lives through Hebrew dates as opposed to English dates, which is another good example. Okay. Meaning sometimes I know that I'll write to somebody, oh, I'll come to you, Parshat Tzav. And like, I know that for them, they're not necessarily thinking about Parshat Tzav. I think about Parshat also because I do a podcast and also because I work in a, you know, yeshiva setting. But for many people, that's not the reference point. And then I know that it means that they're going to their calendar and like they're looking
at you're happy. You're happy you made them do that.
No, but I mean that seriously. And I think it's the same. Again, I don't, not like I'm doing it to be, you know, educational all the time. But many of us, we choose to adopt a frame that makes a very clear statement about what our reference point is. And so the one you're pointing to is obviously important is the Mikdash. And I think that many people today, because we also feel like we live in a world that pulls us in other directions that are not necessarily in Torah directions. So we also think about how do we make that our starting point? How do we make that our frame for what we do? And I think that it's a related like internal space that Chazal are dealing with, obviously in a different world setting, more of like secular world versus like a religious reality. But I think that example is so fascinating. And look, you read, I pointed to Shuli. You couldn't see that in the podcast because you can't see me. But I pointed to Shuli because I'm in the middle of trying again to learn all of Mishnayot. And it is. It's really overwhelming, the amount of information that is not connected to the reality that we're living in. And so in order to understand a basic thing they're saying, I have to go back and read the explanation about, you know, what then, what they were doing in the Mikdash.
And you just look at, let's say, the Shulchan Aruch, right? That cuts that stuff out.
Yes.
We're not, ironically, because right. He comes to the land of Israel. But you know, we don't need that. The Rambam keeps it all in. The Rambam has Hilchot Beit HaBchira, etc. But by the time we get to a little later in the Middle Ages, no, let's talk about the stuff that's more relevant to us. I'm not saying he doesn't think about the Mikdash, but when you're going to create your manual for everyday life, you're going to cut those things out.
Yeah. And look, it's this ever-present tension between old and new. You're obviously speaking about something much more foundational than just the old and new that we could deal with today. Or, you know, should we preserve dressing habits that were in Poland, you know, 300 years ago? That's it. That's a tension. I think it's related. It's obviously, I think, slightly less critical and foundational to who we are. But it's a similar question of, like, how much do we relish the past and do we make it part of our future? And how much do we say, okay, like that was a really, and another element that we didn't really speak about now, but you know, it's a very large chunk of the Torah. And so to not preserve that right. part of life,
you
means
can't
we're
ignore
literally
it.
Bidyuk. You can't, it's very different than preserving Polish dressing habits 300 years ago, because these are things that are just the basis of so many psukim in the Torah. So how do we preserve that in our world? Again, as we get farther away from it, I think that it becomes, you know, as you said, Shulchan Aruch becomes easier to just focus on the here and now. And that's why I think that there is a certain movement today in Israel that some of these ideas, you know, become more practical. We could really speak about basing measurements on the Shivat Haminim, because
I think it's such beautiful examples, because it's Chazal almost being a little sneaky. Right? Like, we're not going to yell at you, oh, you have to think about Eretz Yisrael all the time. We're going to tell you, this is what you should do. This is how we should. Oh, and just so you know, the angels, they only speak Hebrew. They don't speak other languages, right? There are all these like little things that are snuck in, by the way, just to make you realize where's your true place in the world. Right?
Again, I think that this conversation is really pushing us to this question of, like, also obviously to think about the content of Beit Mikdash reality versus where we are today. But I think it actually beseeches us to ask this like religious question of like, what are our frames of reference for things? You know, again, I said I was sneaky when I tell people I'm coming for Parsha X, you know what I'm saying? But like, I think that it's a really important question. And so many people have a hard time with this. Like, they really identify much more with a world whose basis is not in religious life, right? The religious perspective feels like it's pulling them in a direction that they're not really occupying mentally. And I think that it's a very significant question to be asking ourselves.
Yeah. About our conversation now, right? If you listen to the radio, they're always talking about October 7th. And I just was listening last week on March 7th. Every time the 7th of the month rolls around, we think, but it's not the 7th of the month, really. Right, we should be thinking about Shmini Atzeret and the Hebrew date, but our focus is very much on that October 7th, and that's the date that we connect to. Or to take a happier example, right? You celebrate your kids' Hebrew birthdays or English birthdays?
Hebrew birthdays.
I don't even
know their English birthdays.
Hebrew birthdays, because we come here and we say this is our. On the other hand, I celebrate my own English birthday because that's how I grew up.
So I changed. I always celebrated it on July 8th, and when I was in college already, I decided to shift it. I can't say I'm a big celebrator, but in general,
you should have both. One more thought, right? You talked about how the parsha really is two parts, and the second part is about the Yimei Miluim, which when you said that, I was like, oh, Miluim, like what my children are doing endlessly.
Yeah.
There's a strong emphasis, of course, on the Kohanim. And we know that Vayikra is called Torat Kohanim by Chazal. And we have so many laws about the Kohanim's, first of all, how they become invested and how they start to work in the Mishkan. What are their obligations and their privileges? What are the Matanot Kuna? And that's another thing that has to undergo a great shift with the Churban. If you were to find a Roman, you know, in the first century before the Common Era and say to him, you know, who is the ruler of the Jews? Chances are good he'd say the Kohen Gadol, right? Even when there are still kings, and remember the Hashmonai kings are also Kohanim, right? The Kohanim occupy an extremely important place in Jewish society, both on a religious level, but also on a political level, also on an economic level. Who are the wealthy people? Obviously not all Kohanim, but you have this stratum of Kohanim living Yerushalayim who are super wealthy, not always through the most scrupulous of means, right? But the Kohanim are the top, the most important. With the Churban, you have two major changes that happen in Jewish population. One is all of these little sects, all of these groups, the Tzedukim and the Essenes, the guys from the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? That all disappears, leaving us with Jews who follow the rabbis and Christians, right? So that's one thing that happens. But the other thing that happens, which is kind of more subtle, is the Kohanim begin to lose their status, right? Now, Kohanim still have status, but it's much more of a, I'm trying to think of the word that I want.
Figurehead kind of.
Yeah, a formal, you know, they get certain privileges, but it's not real, right? So yes, when you have a Kohen at your table, you always ask him to bench. And he does Birkat Kohanim. And he has obviously certain restrictions on marriage and divorce and all of that. But in reality, Chazal very, very quickly start to steer away from the Kohanim as the elite and the leaders of the Jewish people. And that's probably because of what happens with the Kohanim at the end of Bayit Sheni, that we have so much corruption and so much bad behavior. And of course, the most famous example is the beginning of Pirkei Avot, right? The chain of tradition. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, misarah liYoshua, liYoshua lizkenim, etc., etc. There are no Kohanim mentioned in that list, right? Kohanim are not part of the chain of tradition. And on the other end of Pirkei Avot, at the very end, in the last parak, you have the midot that you need for if I'm remembering correctly, right, you need a certain number for kihuna, but you need more for Torah, right? And the most important is a shem tov. And you don't have this idea. The idea is that anybody can become a Talmid Chacham as long as you work hard enough. Obviously, not anybody can become a Kohen. Right, so Kohanim a little bit get, not a little bit, I think a lot, get shifted out of their place as the elite. And that's something that happens in the wake of the Churban, but probably also in the wake of the Kohanim's behavior in those last decades of the Second Temple.
I think it also reminds me of when populations immigrate somewhere, right? I'm thinking now, let's say, like the Ethiopian community, and like the elders or like the leadership of the community, I mean, just totally crumbled because they moved to society that didn't place an importance on that, right? That we don't have the same respect for elders, and that's something that really like disintegrated for them. And it was a real, also a real breaking point. It is a real breaking point, like in the community. And, you know, we have, it's also painful. You know, people who are used to a certain status. I'm also thinking of people who, you know, become refugees. And somewhere, I was just reading an article on Shabbat with a woman who was saying that they lived in Iran before the revolution. Her parents were in their Jewish family, ultra wealthy. They had servants. And, you know, they saw what happened in the revolution. Their father, her father was wise enough and said, we're getting out of here. And they came to Israel literally with nothing. He was like an unbelievably successful banker, everything, connections. He came to Israel. They lived in a nothing apartment. Her mother was used to having multiple servants. They had nothing. And she said, my parents were unbelievable. Like, they didn't speak the language, nothing. And they built themselves up. Now, obviously, I'm taking into like regular life examples, and you're specifically pointing to our like basis of our Jewish tradition examples. But I'm just trying to sort of underscore what like the emotional, what the emotional dimension of that must have felt like, of literally just having like the carpet pulled out from underneath your feet. And I don't know. And again, we don't think about it as so bad today because my next door neighbor is a Kohen, like, you know, okay. Like what, and mostly I think that they mostly just suffer because of the marriage and divorce restrictions, which can be complicated, but it's very, very difficult to be a level, a strata of society that like loses that kind of special status.
Right. I think you're looking at it in terms of the Kohanim and the difficulties. I think in terms of the rabbis, it's actually maybe a little bit of a relief.
Oh, sure. Well, they didn't have, because the rabbis represent Torah,
rabbis,
and they don't have that
Torah
competition.
And Torah is democratic.
Nachon.
And
you're already opening
not.
Up another really interesting door about the fact that the hierarchy that existed in a Mikdash situation
crumbles.
And that, I think, is also related to the world we live in today. And it brought with it probably a whole bunch of good things, which is, as you said, meaning the democracy element of Judaism is much more present in a world without a mikdash.
Right.
Because our religious world is much less hierarchical. And so you you have these rabbanim, but the only way that they have power is if the people accept their authority.
Exactly.
And so that's very different than a world with king, which is, again, this is part of why these questions about, you know, are we looking to reverse Chazal's work in the future come up, because, you know, and this is a philosophical question. We minorly touched upon it in my conversation with Dr. Yoel Finkelman, but this question about, you know, what political system is the most fitting for Jewish life, and ultimately democracy. It has largely, it's been a great system, but of course this is a big question for us.
It's the worst system except for all the others, as the quote goes.
Yes, exactly. That's of course true. But I think that point is important about the Kohanim losing their stature. It sort of definitely then historically created much more room for the Rabbanim, who were already in enough competition with all the different groups and you know.
But it's a very complicated thing, because the Torah clearly yes. chooses the Kohanim.
Yes.
Plus you have this tension throughout Tanakh between, you know, this chosen group yeah. and everybody else who wants to be chosen, right? Think about Korach, yeah. right? Think about with Yerovam and the Leviim, right? You have this tension that's going on. And when the Mikdash disappears and when it's destroyed, we're able to sort of resolve this tension, but we still have the question of, okay, but what did God really mean when he elevated this one group above all others?
I think I'll just end with one point, which is exactly that word they used about tension, that I think last year in a number of episodes, we spoke about the idea that I think it was Adina Sternberg who said this, she framed that the Kohanim are figures in Am Yisrael who live with more religious tension than we do. And just like we live with, meaning our obligations upon us, the special things that the Kohanim have to keep and do and physical form are representational of the fact that in theory, they are supposed to live with a greater degree of spiritual tension, which comes with the obligations on them. Just like Am Yisrael also is supposed to be living with a greater degree of spiritual responsibility and tension than other nations who don't necessarily have
that.
We
are the Kohanim of the world.
Exactly. So that was something that came out of that conversation. And I just think that interestingly, what happens in a world bereft of Kohanim in that way is that tension gets diffused to the. And there's just a basic human reality, which is that most people don't like to or are not interested in living with that kind of responsibility. And so to sort of focus it on a group is to say, well, they represent us and they're going to live with that. They're going to represent that. They're going to handle that responsibility because it's a little bit like even when people ask me a halacha question. Someone sent me a question yesterday and she's like, okay, I don't remember this. I read it in a book, but can you just explain it to me in your own words? And like, meaning people want authority often in religious right. life, even when we're thousands of years past when the world of Kohanim was present. And again, I was just there to explain, right, and just clarify. But people in general want to feel led. And so there's been a benefit, I think, to sort of the diffusion of power, if we can call it that, from the time of the Kohanim. I'm actually not sure that people would want it to remain that way. Like, I think that this is an interesting question.
Interesting. But you also have to be a good steward of your power, which they were not.
Nachon, I think in the end, the Torah is representing, you know, an ideal, and the way it meets reality is always going to be very complex. Shuli, thank you so much for being here today for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
It gave us a lot to think about. And I think also just really, again, I feel like as the series has continued, and I mean, I'm thinking also about episodes that are coming up, I really appreciate that these conversations are hitting at, to me, what are very real everyday life questions about, like, our religious lives and the ideas and the tensions and the goals that we're, you know, always trying to keep in mind. So I appreciate that you've brought that up again in a whole bunch of interesting ways for us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode from Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please contact the Matan office or email me at podcast@matan.org.il. Please do us and all women's Torah learning a favor and share this episode with all of your friends and family.